Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. We are your hosts, Angela Chang,
Louis Kai,
and Mike Venancaza.
Today on episode 100, we are here with frequent contributor and friend of the podcast, Dr. Ajay Kurian of the Flom Eye Institute, to help us interview a very special guest. We are extremely excited to be joined by Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology at Bascom-Palmer, podcaster extraordinaire, and semi-professional MBA analyst, Dr. Jay Sridhar.
Today, we discuss his career trajectory, the evolution of this podcast, and his first years as an ophthalmology attending here at Bascom.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now pleased to welcome the very special guest we have today, Dr. Jay Sridhar.
Feels weird to be on the opposite side of that intro. Hopefully this won't be too awkward.
No, this is going to be fantastic. Today we're joined with one of our head writers, Mike Venancaza.
Hi there.
And one of our favorite guests, Dr. Ajay Kurian.
Great, thanks for having me, Jay.
And this is Louis Kai speaking. So as we like to ask all our guests here who are new to the show, why retina? Why ophthalmology? And how did you decide you wanted to be a doctor?
I'm not sure how the guests answer this question so easily every time. I've told a lot of people, I think this feels semi-narcissistic to do, so I'm just going to throw that disclaimer out there before we start. But I think the two best decisions I ever made were going to ophthalmology and then going to retina. So they're different stories. So going to ophthalmology, I think, was a much more difficult decision. I was one of those people in medical school where I thought about a lot of different things. When I went to medical school, I was thinking about doing oncology, and then went through our basic science years, and you know, people don't really know what they want to do. You join this interest group, you join that, when you're at University of Miami, at least as a medical student. And then towards the end of the year, we did our neuroscience module, and I thought that was interesting. And then I was like, well, maybe I want to do something neuro-related, like neurology. And I was like, well, maybe I want to use my hand. So then I actually did neurosurgery research. So I did neurosurgery research throughout my second year. And I'm not really sure, you know, I think towards the end of that, I worked with some great neurosurgery residents, and actually the doctor I worked with was a pediatric ICU doctor who did spinal cord research in piglets, and that was interesting, that was kind of a cool experience, but the resident that I specifically worked with was super nice, but also very upfront, and he was just talking about how the sacrifices that he had kind of made to do neurosurgery from a lifestyle standpoint and from the things he enjoyed giving up standpoint were very difficult. And you know, I think that sort of turned me off a little bit, not because I'm not someone who doesn't work hard, I like to work hard, but I was thinking of something with a little more work-life balance. Started clinical rotations, not really knowing what to do. I did medicine and surgery first. I thought I wanted to do medicine or oncology when I started my medicine block. I thought at the end of that block I was not going to do those things. And so I'm here in November, December of my third year, and I have no idea what I want to do. You have done all the major blocks, and which are medicine. Everyone says do medicine and surgery, and then you'll know what you want to do. And I did both of those, and I was like, I actually have no idea what I want to do. There were two saving graces. The first is we had a required two-week module, which was a combined ophthalmology-dermatology lecture series in second year. And so I saw that, and I saw both those things, and I was like, oh, dermatology seems kind of gross, and ophthalmology seems kind of cool. So I signed up early in third year for an elective in ophthalmology for February or March of my third year. But it wasn't still really on my radar. It was kind of like a throwaway. It was like, I'll do that. You know, it's a good experience. I'll see what happens. The second thing was I did a lot of research, and I sat there and took these aptitude tests. The University of Virginia has like this aptitude test. It was like 140 questions that I took. Then there was this book I bought called Choosing Your Medical Specialty. It was like $15 on Amazon. I read those things. I took the test. I did like the Myers-Briggs personality thing. I think mine said INTJ. I looked at the box. I didn't like any of the specialties in that box. I took those tests. I didn't like any of the specialties in my top 10. I would try to like retake it to get answers I wanted. And I read about these specialties, and I was like, oh, maybe I would be like a radiation oncologist, but I didn't know anything about it, or a pathologist. And so I really was nowhere. I was kind of drifting a little bit. And then I did OB-GYN, and I was like, I'm not going to be an obstetrician or gynecologist, but I liked it more than I thought I would. Yeah. And then I did ophthalmology, and after I did a 2-week elective, and after the end of my first week, I was like, this is what I want to do. Why? I'm not really sure. I worked with good people. The first two ophthalmologists I worked with were ophthalmology residents, were Will Park and Ryan Eisen, were both well-known retina specialists now, and really good friends of mine, and people I look up to, and I looked up to at that point. But the first time I saw cataract surgery in the OR, I was just like, this is just like the coolest thing in the world. And it was something about the precision, it was something about how visual it was something about how, as a medical student, people talk about ophthalmology being difficult because you can't do anything in the clinic, you can't help people. But you can still learn things by pattern recognition. So you can look at a patient, the 6 or 7 patient of the day, and be like, oh, that's a nuclear sclerotic cataract, like through the side scope. Or you can look at something and be like, oh, is that like diabetic retinopathy of fundus hemorrhage? Like, you can start to come from patterns together and not sound like a complete idiot. But yeah, I was sold after a week. I remember I told Ryan Isom, I was walking with him from the VA back to Bascom Palmer, and he was going to Bascom Palmer, I was going back to medical school. And I was like, I'm definitely going to be an ophthalmologist. And he was like, that's good. He's like, that's great. And he's like, it's a great field. You'll be really happy. It's just like, he's like, being a first year resident, very, very hard. And yeah, and retina was much easier. I think retina was, we got exposed to a lot of it. And honestly, we kind of did, Ajay can comment too, I think we both did process of elimination too, because we liked a lot of different subspecialties, and it came down to the end, glaucoma and retina for me and for you, I think. And I think the thing that sold me on retina was just that there was, at this point in time, more capacity to improve vision than there is in the glaucoma field, though that hopefully will change as the glaucoma field advances more and more, and kind of, you know, they just need their anti-VEGF breakthrough that we've had, and that will. Those are both very similar fields, in that you have to deal with patients with poor vision, you deal with patients who are essentially suffering nerve damage and through various mechanisms, and you're dealing with patients that for years couldn't really be treated. But the advantage with retina is now we have some treatments that become available that actually can reverse damage. It's a long answer.
Well, I'm glad that all worked out for you. Thanks for sharing that. Like, in college, high school, was it always medicine? Was there something else that you thought?
No, that's an interesting question. And I am rarely dishonest, so... I'll be honest, my parents were both physicians, but I was a smart kid when I was growing up, but I was also a dumb kid when I was growing up. And what I mean by that is, like, I was smart in the sense that I was, like, reading books and learning and doing well in school, but, like, if you came to me when I was 10 or 11 and be like, hey, what do your parents do for a living? I was like, I don't know. You're laughing, Louis, but it's true. I had very little concept. I didn't even know. My earliest memory of thinking my parents were doctors was probably when I was, like, 9 or 10. I don't know what I thought they did before then. They were just my parents, but I clearly wasn't on thinking very clearly. The other thing, it feels weird because a lot of people who talk about their parents being doctors are like, oh, you know, my parents were doctors when I was 3 or 4. I remember being 4 years old and going to my doctor's office and doing this. I have none of those memories. I must have just blocked them all out. My dad passed away when I was 12. That did not, and again, I could use that and be like, that's what inspired me to doctor. It wasn't really. I mean, I still did not see myself doing that. I thought I was going to be an engineer or a historian, or in my deepest fantasies, like a professional basketball stats manager person. I was way ahead of, like, the sabermetric revolution. I could have been like the next Daryl Morey, but I wasn't smart enough to do that. So the point was that I was in high school. I applied for the combined program at UM, which is a combined medical program. So you get admission to medical school. I felt a little disingenuous because I didn't feel at that point fully committed to doing medical school. And I think that was different than a lot of my peers when I got to undergrad, because I felt like we had a class of 20 people. I felt like everyone was like wanted to be a doctor. You know, they had talked about wanting to be a doctor and they wanted to be a doctor. And I wrote that stuff and I talked about it, but I was also very honest when I interviewed that, like, I wasn't 100% sure. And I honestly was using that as an opportunity to just kind of explore and figure out what I wanted to do. My two older sisters went to the same program. My oldest sister wanted to be a doctor, went to the program, did the program. She's now an interventional radiologist and super successful. My second sister was similar to me, where she went to the program, wasn't convinced she wanted to be a doctor, and she ended up just graduating with her undergrad degree, did a PhD in public health, and never went to medical school. And what she was telling me was, like, you know, you can do this and you keep your options open, but you can kind of use this to decide what you want to do. And so I went to undergrad. I think the first year of undergrad, I didn't do any of the pre-med recs because I was like, I'm not going to do medical school. And then at the end, towards the end of that year, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do, because we had 6 years. So it was 2 years of undergrad. So at the end of that first year, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to take an extra year. am I going to just do something else entirely? I had this like heart to heart with my oldest sister and with my mom, and I was just like, you know, I'm not opposed to doing medicine. I feel like I should know more about it because I have so many family in it, but I don't. I don't have this exposure that necessarily other people have. And then I decided I was going to do it, and then that first semester of second year sucked because I did like
cramming all your
Tuesday. Yeah, you know, so UM, there's Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes, there's Tuesday, Thursday classes. Yeah. I did Tuesday, Thursday. I was in class from 8 to like, and those Tuesday, Thursday classes were long. They were like 75 minutes. Yeah. I did like 5 75-minute classes back to back to back to back to back, which were all pre-med recs. It was like physics, organic chem, whatever, what a bio, cell bio, the other bio, ecology, like all this stuff. And then Mondays, I did Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I took Portuguese, which was not high yield, if you ask any of my Portuguese patients. And then I went to medical school, and it was the same thing. Like within a couple of weeks of medical school, I was like, this is what I like to do. I like helping people. I like taking care of people. I really enjoyed the material. That is the hidden third best decision, but I don't feel it was an educated decision. I feel it was lucky. I feel it was lucky to have the opportunity. It was lucky to like do it in that fashion. I think people ask me about combined programs, and I don't want to take this off topic, but you guys both did kind of a combined program too. 7 and 7, I believe, right? You guys
did. I took the extra.
So you did 8 years.
I did 8.
So you did. Louis did 7 years. Mike did 8. I did 6. People ask, is it a good thing or a bad thing? And I'm saying for most, I actually don't think it's the best thing for most people to do in 6 years. For me, it worked out. And I think if I had done a traditional 4-year undergrad, maybe I don't go to medical school. Maybe I lose interest. Maybe I do something else. And maybe I'm not where I am now, where I'm really happy.
Right. Oh, well, that's a perfect bridge to ask you about how it feels to be the youngest faculty member at Bascom-Palmer and youngest resident ever at Bascom-Palmer.
We have to talk about this.
We do.
I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I don't feel that on a daily basis. I don't actively think about that is a very good answer. Someone asked me last week, I was out to dinner with one of my colleagues, Victor Villegas, who you know well, he was faculty here and was a fellow here before that. And he asked me how old I was, and I told him the wrong age, unintentionally, because I had forgotten, you start losing track of how old you are. I don't know if you guys have had this experience too. You guys might be, Mike and Louis might be too young. Ajay, you might.
It's definitely happening.
I mean, you just turned 35 like a week ago, right? Yeah. But like, so I'm 29, right? So that's young for this stage. I don't really think about it anymore. It doesn't really play into what I do or in a role. I probably felt it somewhat. I felt it more in medical school, probably. I felt it less in residency. And then I felt it not at all in fellowship and after that. I think it's just a function as you get older, like the gap doesn't matter as much. It's probably also a function as once you start working with other people. I mean, people work with people of age spectrum in every other specialty, right? So you look at nurses, they come out of nursing school, they're 22. Some of them are still in their 50s and 60s, and they all work together. And at some point, that seniority gap doesn't matter, except when you're talking about pop culture in the OR, and they're like, hey, what was the question they asked me last week? They're like, oh, they asked me if I knew some singer. I had no idea who it was. And I asked if it was the same person as like Michael Jackson. And they're like, I was kidding, but they were like, and they were very offended.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I was also kind of on the younger side because of the combined program. And what you do feel in medical school when you're like just learning to be an adult, and everyone else is already an adult, and you're supposed to act like an adult and speak in an adult fashion. You can't like hang out with your high school bros and like have like say, you know, inside jokes, and it's a little bit different to be an adult. And
I think that UM does a good job. I think, I don't know how other integrated programs are, but like you're in the program that's combined, but once you leave undergrad, it's not like you're separate from the rest of the medical school, right? So like I always thought that was a benefit, is that you leave the combined program part, the 2, 3, 4 years, like, or 4 years of Mike, you go to medical school, and all of a sudden you're just a pool. You're just part of the medical school student pool. So it's not like for 4 years, everyone's like, oh, those are the, in our case, 15 of us or 14 of us, those are the 14 kids who are younger than everyone else, right? You know, it was kind of, you just get dispersed and you make your different friends. And I think a few people stuck together if they were close friends in the undergrad. I feel like my closest friends from medical school all tended to be actually people who were slight, what you call quote unquote non-traditional. There are people who would be like 2 or 3 years off, took 2 or 3 years off and then went back to medical school after undergrad. I think it's from a social perspective, it can be tricky, you know. Not that anyone at this table would ever do anything social like drinking before the age of 21.
Never.
but you know, it's difficult when, you know, there's social events and they're like, oh, bring your ID, and you're just like, okay. That doesn't really help me in this scenario. It ended up not being an issue. But yeah, I think that it only came up like in social context. I think when you're at school, it doesn't actually matter.
No.
That's what I was going to say, was like the classroom setting. Everyone's kind of equal. Like I feel like if you went to like a, because medical school is like a continuation of school. Whereas right. if you graduated and went to like a business kind of job, it might feel a little bit different being younger.
Yeah. That's true. That's a good point.
It also helps that you're exceptionally mature, which I think...
It helps that I'm exceptionally tall. I think that also helps.
Well, so we talked a little bit about what brought you to medicine, what brought you to retina. What inspired the podcast?
So we talked about this once before. I'm going to keep it short because I think if people listen, they're going to be like, oh, you already told a story. But I mean, I think the thing was just like, I hate commuting and I hate driving and I hate listening to the radio. I think like the radio is like the worst. And it's just so repetitive, and the ads, and you end up flipping stations, and it's like, not to get super existential, but you start really questioning like the purpose of life when you hear like the same ad on like four different stations recycling. It's like podcasts. Like I didn't start listening to podcasts until late. Probably I was a late adopter. I probably still listen to podcasts when first or second year of fellowship, like when I was working out or working on research. And so when I was thinking about getting a job, initially my job was going to include a lot of commuting. And so I was just like, I need to figure out something to do when I commute. So I was looking for resources. I wasn't planning on starting a resource. I was just like, I want to partake in the experience. And there was no experience really that matched what I was looking for. So Will Park kind of gave me the push in the end. But as well as Sunir Garg, who's one of my mentors from Will's, kind of gave me the push to kind of just say, hey, if like there's a need and you don't see it filled, you should just do it. And I think a lot of origin stories are like that, right? Is that it's actually something you want for yourself, selfishly in a way, and it's not there, and then you realize you can provide some benefit, hopefully.
And now we're, what, a year and a half in? This is episode 100. Mm-hmm. In this time period, what's been the most challenging thing of keeping the podcast running on a day-to-day?
Well, I mean, again, I say this all the time, and I'm not just saying this to flatter you guys. I think it would be impossible if you and Louis and Angela weren't working so well on making this a reality. I mean, I think it was so easy when I started because you're not busy clinically when you start in practice. So like the first, I was like, oh, I can do this easily. I can budget X amount of time to record an interview and edit it and post it. And you guys have taken away a lot of that work. By dividing the labor, we've actually made it feasible for all of us, right? Where you guys have clinical rotations, you're busy, I'm working, our rotations can fluctuate, you may have tests, you may have days you're later in the OR, like Angela couldn't join us today because she was in the OR, but we can make it work because we have redundancy. I think the most challenging thing at this point is just keep not being flaky with interviews and tracking down people for interviews, because the people we bring on as guests are so busy that finding a time that works for both of you to sit down and talk even for 20 minutes, and people usually don't want to overcommit, right? So they don't want to pick 20 minutes when they're eating lunch. They want to pick 20 minutes when they have a lot of time. Finding that time and then having both parties be able to stick to that time when things come up is really challenging. Like, and I feel badly because sometimes I'll be, like this past Monday, I had 4 interviews stacked in the afternoon. And then all of a sudden, the night before, you know, get news of 2 add-ons for the OR. And I'm just like, it's just not going to happen. And now I have to communicate to these people who have already agreed to give up their time to me. I have to communicate that, hey, I'm really, really sorry. I'm not trying to be a flake, but this is just the realities of what I do. I really want to do this. Can we do this another time? And there's some attrition that comes with that. And that's a hard thing, right? Is you want to stay ahead. I always try to think 3 or 4 episodes ahead so we're not scrambling, we're not behind deadlines in terms of getting something consistently out there. But it comes in waves. I feel like if I have a good day where I don't get called to a lot of things, I can knock out all 4 or 5 interviews I've scheduled. And then we have the next 3-4 weeks lined up. If that day gets killed by something coming up, then all of a sudden we're behind and now we're scrambling a little bit. So that to me is the biggest challenge, is trying to get everyone on the same page. I think people appreciate on some level how much work we do. People will say, that must be a lot of work. You guys do a great job. I don't need to give you guys enough credit because I'm kind of the person who's always talking, but the most challenging thing is there's actually a lot of work that goes into every episode. And then people don't understand, I think, that you have to do background research, right? So if I'm interviewing Louis, you know, I need to know some things to ask him to make the interview flow. I don't want to hit a wall, right? So I want to know what his research is and like what his interests are and what things he's published on. Because what I don't want to do is interview Louis and then have a listener be like, I can't believe you interviewed Louis and you didn't ask him about this huge project he did. And I'm like, I didn't know about that. So you need to have some background research because you don't want to leave gaps. You're never going to be able to find out everything about a person, but you want to kind of hit the high points that people would want to know from that person. So that takes some background research. And then thankfully we have an abundance of guests like to pick from. We have so many people in Retina. But I'll have times when I'll hit a wall and I'm like, I just don't know what ideas we're going to have. Like, I'm like, what's new? We have to think of something that's different or new. We don't want to be repetitive. And then I'll have days where I'll just be like, oh, this person would be great. And this person would be great. And this person's great. And seizing those moments and writing those names down is super important because I don't want to think a day later when I'm tired, I'm like, I don't remember who I was supposed to like interview. Yeah. So staying organized is really critical too. Google Calendar has been my friend, as it was for you when you were interviewing.
Right. So for me, there were some episodes that I really felt like those were some pivotal moments that I really felt like all the things that we were doing were worth it. Like, for example, the episode with Dr. Tasman, like that one like really struck home and like really made me question like why I wanted to do medicine and maybe rethink my priorities. Were there any moments like when you were interviewing someone that you found like really rewarding?
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to offend anyone. I mean, every guest who comes on is awesome, right? So like I've thought about sometimes, like, it's 100 episodes, maybe we should do like our top 5 favorites each. And I'm like, that could be like, they're all great, right? They're all great in their own way. And I don't want to pick favorites, but I'll pick up, I'm just off the top of my head, just thinking. I think that there's three moments, I'll say. The first is Andy Lauer came on maybe episode 11-ish. I don't remember the exact number. And just the things he talked about, the challenges of modern residency education, but also like the passion he had for it. They made me like remember why I wanted to be in academics and why I wanted to be in education. I think talking to someone who shares like your passions can light that fire back in you again. So I thought for me, I really enjoyed doing that. The second thing is I really, really enjoy doing like the match panel with UM students. I know that sounds corny, but I think it's awesome. I think you guys are super impressive. You guys are excited. You guys are enthusiastic. You guys haven't lost that fire. So again, Ajay can attest to this, but like we can get caught in the daily grind. Seeing patients, filling out paperwork, responding to emails, departmental meetings, and like you forget, hopefully not all the time, but sometimes you forget how much you really enjoyed some of this and how passionate you were when you matched and you found out you matched and what you wanted to do. And hearing you guys talk about that is super cool. And it kind of makes you feel, not to make myself sound old, but it makes you feel young again, like you're back in that moment. And then the third thing was, I think that, and this is personal for me because, you know, I had 3 sisters growing up and my mom was a working physician. My mom was a single mom from the time I was 12 and she had 5 kids, right? So anytime, and especially I'm going to say like Zelia Correa came on and talked about this, but like talking about like discrepancies, you know, and we've talked a lot about women in retina or women in general in medicine, that always strikes a chord with me, right? Because there's a difference between knowing there's a problem and the difference between not knowing there's a problem but not being okay with the problem, right? And let me give you an example. So I'm at the store last week and I see a family with 2 young kids, young boy, young girl, probably like between 4 and 6. And they're both like making these things with like the plastic bags at the grocery store. And the mom turns to the son and is like, oh, like you're super creative. Like you're always building stuff. You're gonna be a great engineer. And the girl's doing the exact same thing. The mom and dad don't say anything to her. Now I'm just picking out that example. I'm not picking on that family, but I'm just saying, before listening to all our guests kind of talk about this unconscious bias and things like that, I wouldn't have even thought twice about that. I would have just gone on with that. But I thought about that and I was like, you know, this is what people are talking about, right? Whether it's gender, whether it's race, ethnicity, background, class, there's conscious bias and then there's unconscious bias, but then there's just casual observership where you don't even recognize that there's a problem because you're not looking for it. And so I think that's one of the things I've learned from the podcast, right? We've taken people from so many backgrounds. We brought Anita Agarwal, and she's talking about her experience coming from India. As like, you don't even appreciate the challenges when she's like, we don't have access. We didn't have access to the GAPS Atlas. We had to bring photocopies from the US to read it and how thirsty for knowledge they were. Now, we're in an internet age now. People are consuming things all the time. But talking to our colleagues abroad who don't share the same resources, it kind of just gives you that perspective. And so like the podcast, Ajay and I talk about, it forces us to stay current in terms of the literature, but I think it forces you to have more worldly perspective and understand different backgrounds because everyone's story of how they got here is a little different. And then the challenges and biases they may have faced because what they look like or who they are or who they weren't also make you think more. So that's not a really specific answer, but that's my long answer to the third type of episode.
Yeah, you know, there's just been so many great episodes and you've been you know, you've had some great guests here on the podcast.
You are the greatest guest I've had. I think actually
I'm the most available.
You're definitely
guest.
The most frequent. We should probably do some metrics, right? He's probably the most frequent guest, not counting me.
We can count the stats.
Yeah.
Solely based on availability. That was what you were talking about, where you get in that rut and you can't think of new things. You're just like, I'll just have him back.
Ajay sounds great. Yeah.
But, you know, two of the things that you talked about really have to do with students and training and things like that. You know, you're such a fantastic mentor. People have talked about you ever since I've left. When I check in with the residents and the fellows, they glow about what a great experience they've had with you.
I slip a $10 bill in everyone's locker every week. That's the secret.
But what are some
sorry
of the,
to disappoint you, Ajay.
What are some of the challenges that you faced with training?
Yeah. Are you talking about with training myself or training other people?
Training other people.
Okay, so there are different challenges. I think mentoring medical students, I'm not saying this because you guys here, is much easier. I think motivating medical students, the challenge with medical students is finding the people who are motivated and then remembering what it was like to be a medical student and not having your expectations being too high. Not that you guys always exceed expectations, but you have to remember, like when I was a medical student, I remember writing a paper for Dr. Byron Lamb here. And if I read that first draft I sent him now, it's not that the writing was bad, but my understanding of what I was writing was not there. I was reading papers and I was writing things, but I wrote a paper about, I don't remember, it was like orbital apex syndrome. I had no idea what that was. I was just writing things based on what I was reading, interpreting it. And he did like, we did like five sets of revisions. He was so patient with me. And I think about that when I work with medical students. As long as they're timely, as long as they put effort, I think that's enough. I think the challenges get harder and harder as people move up in training because your expectation level has to slide up. So, and the amount of responsibility you have to give them goes up. So that's my talk actually at VidBuckle this year, is the challenges of staffing fellows, for example. I think staffing fellows versus staffing residents is completely different because there's a different expectation. When I was a fellow staffing residents, I would have the resident, like we had a combined phaco vitrectomy case. I have them do the phaco and then start the vitrectomy. And that was like a huge bonus for them, right? But that wasn't that stressful for me because it was easy. You just have them go in the middle, kind of do some vitrectomy, come out. Maybe they do some endo laser if it's an easier case. It's different when you're the attending, and now you have to think that you want this fellow to try to do as much as possible because they're going to be a doctor in less than a practicing independent surgeon sometimes in less than a year, in a few months. And then from a mentoring or research perspective, I think I don't find that as challenging because I've had good role models and mentors like going through. I'm going to forget somebody, but Dr. Lamb or Dr. Karp or Dr. Johnson, Tom Johnson, when I was a medical student, or Dr. Flynn when I was a resident, or as a fellow like Dr. Garg or Dr. Sivalingam, and people who like are available. So I think the biggest thing I've learned about being a mentor and being, I'm still someone's mentee and I'm also someone's mentor, is just being available. As a mentee, I understand that if I text Dr. Garg a question and he's busy and I want to just get his thoughts on something, I don't expect a response right away. But he always does respond. And as a mentor, I understand that when Louis sends me a question or sends me something, he understands I'm not going to get to it right away, but I'm not going to ignore him. I'm going to respond. I'm going to take time for him.
I really appreciate that.
Well, because, I mean, yeah. You have to think about it. Like, we've all been on the other side where people haven't responded in timely fashion or haven't been up to date. And we all miss stuff. Like, I never thought I would miss emails. But when you get this many emails and this many things to take care of, sometimes you forget. You're like, I need to respond to that. You see it on your phone. You don't respond to it. But just trying to remember to, like, make time for people. Yeah, I could talk more about staffing fellows, but that's kind of my talk. I don't want to ruin it. It's not very good, but I don't have that high a threshold.
All right, so now as an attending, so in fellowship, you're just starting to learn the fundamentals of the surgeries, but as an attending, are these fundamentals coming as second nature, or are you still kind of improving, or?
Ajay can comment too, even though he's not being interviewed, I kind of want to reel him in and take some of the answers from me. I think I've learned more as an attending staffing fellows in a year and a half than I learned in 2 years of fellowship. And that's not because I didn't learn. I learned a ton in 2 years in fellowship. But you learn so much more when you're supervising and when you're doing things that are the most difficult steps and more difficult cases sometimes, when there's no safety net, essentially, to bail you out of difficult situations. And when, unfortunately, sometimes situations become more difficult because of the nature of staffing someone who's training. So. There are definitely I appreciate my fellowship training because there are certain things that are second nature. I can, and Mike watched me operate the other day. He can be honest when I leave and be like, "Oh, it wasn't second nature at all. This guy needs help." But like certain things, just the thinking, the thought process, how fast you do. I'm not thinking when I'm putting oil in an eye. How do I put oil in an eye? I'm not thinking when I'm doing laser. How do I hold the laser probe? Like, all those things are second nature, like muscle memory. I can do them. And that's very, very helpful, because the hardest part, at least in my brief experience, and people more experienced should comment on top of me, the hardest part of being a retinal surgeon ultimately isn't the actual technical part. It's the decision making. It's deciding when you've done too much and you should stop or you should do more. Mm-hmm. It's deciding, do we need to treat this or do we not treat this? Deciding what type of treatment to do for something. That's the more nuanced thing. Even that starts becoming second nature when you do it more. But yeah, so I would say, like, and Audrey can come to, certain things are second nature. You do them so much, you're not even thinking. Like, I can close sclerotomies practically in my sleep. I can just do it. I'm not even thinking about it as I'm doing it because I've done it so many times. Other things, like, I've been in this situation only a couple times. What is the next step that would be best for the situation? Maybe that's when I will pause and take a step back. And I think that's what people have talked about. You learn so much more as an attending in practice, in a way. But I am very thankful, because I think my fellowship training really, and a residency training too, kind of helped really reduce that learning curve, where it wasn't learning how to do things, it was learning when to do things. And I learned a lot of that in fellowship too. It's just kind of fine-tuning it now. I don't know if you have comments, Ajay.
Yeah, I think I echo what you were saying. There's so much that is second nature, but then there's still all these new areas to grow, and sometimes it's pushing yourself to do different things, and sometimes it's pushing yourself out of your comfort zone with training trainees during surgery. And so there's always room to continue to grow and have things that are not second nature, and I think that's one of the beauties of being a retina surgeon, or just any surgeon in general. But it's a nice balance of some new things that you're continuing to develop and some things that you're more comfortable with.
All right. So just shifting gears, after this is our 100th episode,
I feel like you're throwing shade. That's like my favorite throwaway thing to do. It's like, now we're shifting gears.
From fourth to fifth. So I was curious, you've interviewed pretty much like 99 guests. This is the 100th episode.
Sure.
And do you have any tips for, you know, as physicians, you know, we often have opportunities to be interviewed by the public.
Okay.
What makes a good guest? Like, how do we better communicate our thoughts? Or what are...
I'm not going to claim I'm good at this. If anyone's listening to this and at this point they're like, man, this is the worst episode, I'm going to delete and go to the next one. But if they're still listening, they think I'm decent, so maybe they'll appreciate these thoughts. I think that a lot of the responsibility does lie with the interviewer. And that's not to say I'm doing a great job, which makes them look good. I'm talking about when I've done these, you need to be clear when you're interviewing someone what you want them to answer. Right? So it can be hard as a physician to do interviews if you're not exactly clear what they're asking you. Right? That's what can be tricky. For example, if they're like, so what are your thoughts on macular degeneration? I mean, that's a very open-ended question. You can take it in so many different directions. Versus, there was a recent publication in The Guardian about this stem cell therapy for macular degeneration. What are your thoughts on that? So as the physician, though, I think the biggest things are not being afraid to take pauses, trying to avoid filler, which I'm not that good at, apparently, and being okay with saying that you don't know something. Don't try to say that if you're not sure of the answer to something, qualify your answer. I think that's more honest and a little safer. I think people can get into trouble two ways. They interview poorly because they don't speak confidently, because they're nervous, they speak too fast, because they're worried. I think the second problem is when they get flustered and then they start making things up, or, you know, if I'm asked a question, I'll be like, I'm not exactly sure. I could read more about that. And so that goes to the final thing, is preparing is very important. So I try to give everyone I interview a skeleton of what we're going to talk about. I think that's polite, it's appropriate. And I think that if I was going to be interviewed, I'd want to know more or less what the structure is going to be, so I understand mentally what I need to read up on. So let's say they were like, hey, Dr. Sridhar, can you come and talk about the latest trials in diabetic retinopathy? I shouldn't expect, unless I'm a savant like Audrey Kurian, to just walk in there and just start spouting off about protocol S and protocol T and protocol U. I'm going to have to do my homework, right? So preparing is important. Just like if you're going to present at a meeting, even if you're naturally good in it, don't take it for granted. I mean, one of my attendings in fellowship, who I thought was a fantastic presenter, was very open and told me that he or she would practice his or her, it's his, but his talk 30 to 40 times before he gave it.
Wow.
Even if he had given it before. In the mirror, to his significant other, just over and over, on the plane while flying to it. And this is someone who is respected, very good speaker, goes across country, does this all the time. Everyone's got different skills. You got to figure out how much you need to do to prepare, right?
Right?
But to me, that was like, wow, like if this person feels they need to do this much preparation and they're this good, then you need to prepare. So interviews are the same thing. You need to know what you're going to talk about.
Wow. So even, I always thought it was, people can just go up and just kind of wax, like just talk about anything, but I didn't realize there's so much preparation.
I think people are different. I think, I mean, you can comment. I mean, some people are better at this. Dan Chow is a great example. He's our co-resident. He's just very eloquent. And then there's some of us who need to practice more. And for me, what helps is visualization. Like when I used to do grand rounds as a resident, I would actually visualize that I was there. And I would sit there and I felt like an idiot. And I would sit by myself in my room with my computer the night before grand rounds and at least two or three times would do my grand rounds verbally. Right? You have to speak it out loud because it sounds awkward when you speak. So you need to hear yourself talking and hear that it sounds funny to you or sounds weird. You don't sound confident. Because you're going to have to do that the next day, and you want to get flustered by hearing yourself speak. That sounds like a weird way to explain it, but I don't know what you think about that.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think practicing makes your confidence go up for everything. And so the more prepared you feel for anything that you're doing, whether it's a talk or an interview or something like that, I think you're just going to feel more comfortable when you're actually doing it.
And we talked a lot about the process of interviewing, the start of the podcast. It's kind of a two-part question. What do you think about for the future of Straight for the Cutter's Mouth?
Right.
Anything you're excited about? And then also just for podcasting in general, what do you think the role of podcasts is going to be in medical education or just not non-medical?
I mean, I think podcasts in general are just continuing to grow if you look at the stats, right? More and more people are using them. I think it's convenient. You can consume it at your own leisure. There are so many options now depending on what you're interested in. And it fits this need where people, it's just like streaming, right? People don't want to sit through commercials. People don't want to wait for the next episode to come out of their TV show. They want it all at once. Podcast gives you an advantage. I can pick up TED Talks today and say, I want to listen to 100 episodes of TED Talks back, whatever. I can do that. I don't have to listen to commercials. Now, they have some reads and whatever. You can skip those very easily. I think podcasts continue to grow. The only thing I would say is I think, and I mentioned this to someone before who asked me this, I would think in about 5 to 10 years, when more and more people are in these crazy self-driving cars, that video is going to take over what podcasts are doing. I mean, people, hopefully they're not doing this now, watching YouTube on their phone while driving, but I think people are going to be consuming videos much more than podcasts. Like people have asked sometimes, they're like, you're talking about these surgical techniques, can you post a video to show us? Why don't you do video? That would require a lot more planning for us, right? We'd have to really be well on top of it, and to get a guest in person or to Skype, it would be very tricky for what we're trying to do. So that's not something really in our future projection. I mean, I think for us, we're doing a reasonable job. You can always do better. That's why we did the survey and things to try to figure out to do better. I think going forward, the two things we've talked about, which would be useful. The first, which has been asked by some people, and Ajay knows about this, is trying to see if we can deliver CME credit to people who listen. Pre-CME credit. CME being that they can use this continuing medical education for their certification and licensure. We have enough episodes, I think, where we do educational type episodes with journal clubs or article reviews, which would fit kind of the bill. And just kind of coordinating the logistics of that to make this something available would really help the listeners, because not only would they be learning, but then they can use that for their CME, and that becomes more time efficient for them. The second thing would be, when are we going to stop, right? So that's something people are, is this something that goes on indefinitely? I don't think anything ever goes on indefinitely, right? You start writing a book series, you're J.R. Tolkien writing Lord of the Rings, you had an end. You start a movie series, you may stretch the last movie of Harry Potter into two parts to make 8 movies and make more money, but you still had 8 movies and it was over. But then you make like the Fantastic Beasts movie and it keeps going. But like, we're going to have a finite end at some point, right? At some point, we're going to say either we've run out of things to talk about, or we've kind of reached a limit, or there's a generational gap where I understand that at some point, I'm not going to be the best person to connect to the next group of fellows or residents, whatever. And then someone like Louis or someone else would step in and take that role, or it just wouldn't happen because we've decided that we've kind of done what we need to do. I don't think that's anywhere in the near future. I think that we've got at least a good year and a half in us, another 100 hopefully. But at some point, I do think that you're going to reach a point where you don't run out of things to talk about, but the motivation and the fire isn't there, right? So if we're not all motivated, you can't just go through the motions and just do it, because then you're just doing it and it doesn't have the same sort of vibe. I think people like the fact that we sound interested and we sound motivated and we enjoy it, and that comes across when we talk, hopefully. If our guests were checked out, or we were checked out, or the editing was checked out, for example, what you guys do behind the scenes, which is super important, then that's a sign that we should probably move on to something else. And, you know, you've had a good run, we've done a good job, now it's time to move on to something different. Kind of depressing.
You put us in some good shadows with Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter there.
Yeah. Well, generationally, I'm kind of the wrong generation for both. Well, I guess the movies were sort of our generation, but Harry Potter I was a little old for-ish.
And speaking of, at the end of our episodes, you often talk sports, random things.
Oh, yeah.
Just want to ask, what are some of your hobbies? What do you like to do?
I mean, I'm on maybe unhealthily, like, an NBA junkie. I mean, I don't watch that much NBA anymore. So when I was a kid, I was one of those kids who watched all the major sports and, like, got the newspaper, and I knew the box scores for all the teams. I knew what the scores for all the games were, like, NHL, NBA, MLB, NFL. And then you start getting older and you start doing other things and that starts dropping, right? So, like, the first thing to drop was, like, NHL and MLB. Baseball and hockey, like, I'm sorry. Like, just not as interesting. And then NBA has always been my number one thing, though. So, like, I love the NBA. College basketball is great. March Madness is going on right now. I'll watch it. I think it's interesting. But, like, the quality of play, how the NBA has evolved, the history of it, the impact. It's so stupid because it is a game. I completely understand it's a game. Audrey can comment too, but it still means a lot, right? And so that's actually the number one thing I'll do when I'm working or driving is consume, you know, podcasts or content related to that. And I don't watch that many games anymore because I don't have time to sit and watch games, but, like, that's why the highlights, like House of Highlights, YouTube has become so huge because you can, like, catch up, you can read, and then you watch, and you read, and you watch. What else? I would like to say I play basketball. I haven't played basketball in, like, 3 years, which is sad. It's probably good to retire on top or on the bottom.
Yeah, I think the last time you played was with me, so that was
it was a long time ago.
A while ago.
I like playing tennis. I like working out. I dabble in running. I like swimming. I think swimming's super. People have talked about this. I'm not like a hardcore swimmer where I'm swimming every day, but I think Eric Nudelman wrote this somewhere. He talks about he swims every day, and, like, that's just, like, his clearest moments. And, like, I think that's definitely true when I swim. I think the best ideas come after 10 or 15 minutes of swimming. And then other hobbies, I like Retina probably too much. Do a lot of Retina. I love trying new restaurants. I think the food scene in Miami is not that awesome right now, but it's gotten better. The food scene in Philadelphia was terrific, Louis, so you have a lot to look forward to. Excited. But I became sort of a foodie, Yelper. I don't Yelp that much, but I consume Yelp a lot, which is probably bad.
Did I tell you that I was Yelp elite and I was the Duke of Bascom Palmer for like a year?
Wait, what? Wow.
I was the most, every time I went for my surgery rotation, I would check in at Bascom Palmer and eventually I had like 100 check-ins. Oh. And then maybe the Duke.
What do you mean the Duke? There's rankings and Yelp?
Yeah, the person who checks in the most frequently becomes the Duke of whatever institution.
So you're saying that if at some point you go to Duke, you could be the Duke of Duke.
So, yeah, you could
be the Duke of Duke.
Yeah.
I expect you to become the Duke of Wales within like 6 months. Because I don't think anyone's checking in on Yelp to Wales Hospital.
They will be now.
They will be now. Well, but yeah, I love trying new foods and traveling. I've tried to travel more. I think traveling's important. I think you lose perspective and it can be easy as you get older to get just comfortable and just be like, I like my life. I like hot showers and I like sleeping in a bed. And it's nice to go somewhere else and be like, you know, not everyone lives with these standards and keep that perspective. Because you don't want to lose that and become, you know, grumpy old physician in your 50s and 60s, which is like, I don't understand why my bank account isn't as big as it should be. And look around and be like, you know, there's actually a lot of people in the world who would love to be in your situation doing what you're doing. So, yeah.
All right. So thank you so much, Dr. Sridhar, for your time.
No, thank you guys. You guys make the podcast. I mean, you seriously, without you, Mike, Angela, and then guests like Ajay, we wouldn't be able to do what we do because I'm not nearly interesting enough on my own, as you've seen from this episode. So the only thing that gets me by is some self-deprecation.
It's okay. We all have fond memories and experiences with working with you, and Andy here to vouch for you.
If that's good. Be. When they come for me.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's R-E-T-I-N-A podcast.com. All 100 episodes, including this one, can be found there, sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal, Round, and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play.
We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on the website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback on things we can do better and things that we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review.
Many thanks to Drs. Jay Sridhar and Ajay Kurian for joining us today. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. Thanks to everyone for supporting us for the past 100 episodes, and we're excited about what the future will bring. Stay tuned. This is Mike Venenkaza,
Louis Kai,
and Angela Chang,
signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.